Ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by the Hagen Oaks Golf Super Shop, America's most awarded golf facility. Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Welcome in to another edition of the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. Hi, everybody. I'm Frank LaRosa, along with Scott Marsh, my co-host. And Scott, here we go with another week of talking about golf. We haven't played much golf lately.
No, it's been terrible. I've been kind of banged up here. I haven't been able to play for a little while, and I've got to get healthy, Frank.
Yeah, well, we'll get you healthy. We'll get back out on the golf course and marvel at how our games have not progressed. On the show today, it's kind of fun. We have a Willie Toney. We have a great story with Willie. Willie is the PGA head professional at Bing Maloney Golf Course, and Willie actually grew up right next to Bing Maloney Golf Course. As a matter of fact, I think it was one street over, if I'm not mistaken, and that was his first job in golf. And Willie went on to work at a number of golf courses, and also including Olympic Club, and returns home to be the head golf professional at Bing Maloney. It's kind of a fun story, and Willie's a great guy.
Just an awesome story. For those who say you can never go home, well, Willie's going to tell them otherwise. It's great that he's back in the place where it all started for him, but I just can't wait to talk to him about his entire career in the game. You talked about being a head pro at so many great courses, and he even tried to become a professional golfer and just get his philosophy on helping others.
Yeah, Willie's a pretty good stick. I've seen him, or I've hit balls next to him on the range. There was a much different sound coming out of his shot than mine. But
when you're a plus index, you know you're doing something right.
Yeah, exactly. Also on the show, returning Mr. Eric Lippert, PGA head golf professional at Pebble Beach. And Eric is going to kind of catch us up on what they're doing down at Pebble Beach to continue to get ready for the 78th U.S. Women's Open coming to Pebble Beach July 5th through the 9th. And, you know, when you have a major tournament and it's right there in your backyard, you don't have that many opportunities. So I would encourage our listeners to go down and take a look at the women. You know, the women probably play a game that is closer to our game than many of the men, because the men hit it so far. But the women, you know, it's all about, and I should, you know, address the fact that they're hitting it farther than us as well. But sure. But their games are really around the green, and it's really exciting to watch the way they set up to the ball and the way they hit the ball, because you talk about accuracy. That's what's really important in the women's game.
Yeah, I wish I could say I had a game near anybody who might be competing in the U.S. Women's Open, because I know I don't. And then all the excitement with Rose Zhang winning this past week, the Stanford star, her first time out winning on the LPGA Tour, people building her as perhaps the female Tiger Woods. That just adds so much to what's going to be going on out there. I can't wait to be a part of it and to talk to Eric all about it.
You know, every time you think that we've reached the zenith and, you know, there will never be another Annika Sorenstam or Tiger Woods or whoever, you know, along comes a young woman like Rose and kind of breaks all records and, you know, sets the golf world on its ear. And certainly the length and the history and the years validate that. But boy, she's off to a great start.
Couldn't be any better to win in your first time out after winning the NC2A championships twice. Her college legacy is one of a kind, so that's amazing. And you know, the case of Eric too, I mean, you got to think about being a head pro at Pebble Beach. Is there a more coveted head PGA job, especially at what is considered a quote-unquote public course in all of America, than what Eric's got?
Pretty exciting. You know, as most people know, we record this show for air on Sactown Sports 1140, and before we sat down today, the announcement was made that LIV Golf and the PGA Tour and the DP Tour have reached an agreement. And I think that it's, you know, it's certainly proper that we recognize that agreement. On the other hand, I don't know how much we can comment on it, because by the time this show airs, who knows what more news will have come out, you know, what actually that agreement means and what it means for the PGA Tour and LIV Golf and the players and so on and so forth. So I guess all we can say is I'm not surprised that an agreement was reached. I guess I'm surprised that it happened so quickly. And we will find out more in the coming days as to what that all means.
It's an ongoing story for sure. But I can say certainly from an initial reaction, I was absolutely shocked. I did not see this coming whatsoever. I was absolutely blown away to see Jay Monahan sitting with the person from the Saudi, which is going to be called the PIF now, announcing the merger together. And it sounds like a lot of the players were caught off guard as well. Colin Morikawa tweeted out basically, yeah, great to find out on Twitter that we're merging with LIV. And so it was just shocking to me based upon what seemed like vitriol between these two organizations. And to your point, I didn't see this coming, certainly not this soon.
Yeah. And as I said, much more to come and much more to come on the Golf to Go Radio Hour. Right after these messages, we will be back with Willie Toney from Bing Maloney.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
You are listening to the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa, along with Scott Marsh, my partner in the show. And Scott, kind of a fun day today. Willie Toney, a very, very old friend of mine. Well, let's say a longtime friend, because he's not that old. But Willie has just recently accepted the position as a head golf professional at Bing Maloney Golf Course. And the exciting part about that story is Willie grew up right next to the golf course. And so it's really kind of he's come full circle. Willie, how are you? Thanks for being on the show.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You know, what is it? I mean, it's got to be 40 years ago or something that, you know, that you were a kid kind of walking around those grounds. And my brothers even worked there at the time. And I know you developed a friendship with them. So how's it feel being back?
It's great. I mean, you talk about, like you said, a full circle moment. This is where my career started. First time I ever hit a golf ball was literally at the bend in the dog leg on 12 on the opposite side of the fence. It was a ball we couldn't sell back. So I took a swing at it and I actually connected and hit it really well. So this has always been considered home for me, though.
Family, you still got some nieces and nephews and some kids and stuff like that. How does everybody feel about you being back in Sacramento?
They're pretty excited. They're probably more excited than I am. I mean, it's incredible because, you know, moving to the Bay Area, I didn't get up here as often, so I wasn't able to visit them as much, but I can definitely visit them now, because at least more frequently, because I'm really close nearby here.
You mentioned the Bay Area, and, you know, I know you were down at the Olympic Club for a while. Tell us, kind of give us the brief tour of your career, you know, from the time you left Bing Maloney there, became a PGA professional and back full circle.
Yeah. So Bing Maloney, so my actual start working at a golf course was in 78. Post high school though, I went down to Prairie View A&M on a golf scholarship in 84 through 88, got a degree in criminal justice, and then came back home. And, you know, I think from day one, I hit that golf ball, I had tour aspirations. And so turned pro post-college. My roommate and I, we played mini tour golf, Golden State back then. And we probably did that for about 4 or 5 years. Didn't have sponsors. So what we would do, we still stayed at home. We'd work, save up our money, and then go play until we ran out. And we do that process over and over again. So that journey, we figured if we weren't going to play professionally, we wanted to keep our game in shape so that if we got another opportunity, we'd have access. And how we got access was we got into the golf business, into the PGA program back then was called the Golf Professional Training Program. And we obtained our Class A memberships through that process. And then Mather was a course that had, because of base closure, got turned over to the county. So that was my first assistant pro job. And then from there down to Stevenson Ranch in the Central Valley, Diablo Grande as well. And I was 4 years there. And then I got an opportunity to go back to the Bay Area with the former Lou Galbraith golf course that's now named Metropolitan Golfing. So I got in there in 2003 as a startup. And so I was there until late 2004. And then an opportunity came up based on, you know, kind of the relationship that you build in this game, which has been great. An opportunity to go to and work at the Olympic Club. And it was just a random phone call. Just happened to, you know, ask about the guys there. It was a former professional. I said, hey, you know, how are the guys doing there? And he says, well, Willie, guess what? A couple of guys are leaving. You should get a resume in. And I kind of laughed and remarked that they're not going to hire me there. You know, I go, they barely have any black members. I go, when are they going to hire a black golf professional? He goes, Willie, with your personality, trust me. He goes, just send in the resume. And just so happens it landed in the hands of Brad Martin. And Mr. Lucius was still alive, Jim Lucius. And he happens to ask Brad, what do you have there? And he says, Willie Tony's resume. And he goes, do you think we can get him in here? He goes, I think so. So that process, I was given two interviews that same week once Chris Stein came back into town. And they made an offer. This is February 2005. I started there. And that was my longest tenure. And originally, Olympic Club was going to be a launching pad, right? And I just wanted it on the resume. But then we had the 07 Amateur. And then a week after the 07 Amateur, they announced that we're having 2012 Open. So I thought it was beneficial to stay there through an Open because I may not work at another facility that would host one. So that created that peril of that long tenure there. And that was a great, magnificent place to work because you're talking about honing some skills and gain some experience and a lot of networking, you know. It afforded me the ability to do some things that I'm doing now, and to come back home full circle is just great. But 20 years in, you know, I think I attained my Class A in 2001. I think when you hit the 20 year mark in this thing, you're considered a life member. So call me a life member of the PGA now.
You know, your answer prompts so many questions. You know, when you talk about the places you've been, you know, for people that may have a job that they start one day and they work 25 years and retire in the golf business, it's certainly not unusual to bounce around a little bit as an assistant professional. But certainly when you look back at it, you know, all of the experience you gained at all of those places is what made you ready, you know, for the job at Olympic Club and why you qualified. And so you have to look back at some of those assignments with a great deal of love and respect, I'm guessing.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, but I probably give the majority of that respect to Bing Maloney because, again, this is where it started. I mean, if Bing Maloney doesn't happen, I don't get introduced to golf here, that career, it's really highly unlikely that I do the things that I did if it wasn't for Bing Maloney.
You talk about hitting that golf ball the first time. And for so many people, it's hard for them to understand the fascination of the game. I mean, you know, they talk about over the years, you know, chasing the little white ball around the golf course. But it's hard to describe the feeling that that goes through your entire body when you get that ball in the air for the first time. And certainly you've become an accomplished player, but you know, talk a little bit more about that, that experience from that first ball and how it got you excited for the game.
So the interesting thing about that is this is the way I explain the feeling that you get when you hit a golf ball that good for the first time. You know, I would just say it would be similar to an addiction, right? And I, you know, I don't know because I'm not a not into drugs at all or anything like that, but I just know that the first time I hit a golf ball, split hand grip, I lifted up my left foot, took a swing back, and I hit it dead center face with a little draw, and I'm dancing around like, you know, I hit the best shot ever, right? But you know what that made me do? What really hooked me was the fact that I hit it that easily on the first try, but couldn't do it again on the second try, or the third, or the fourth, or the fifth. So, and I'm one of those kids that's always been kind of self-motivated. I'm a middle child by position in my family. You know, so we were kind of more independent, but golf was what got me that swing and that shot is what I chase every day when I come to the golf course. Back then as a kid, I couldn't do it as consistently as I can do it now. So I get that feeling a lot when I play or practice. I chase the feeling of that first shot hit.
Scott, I know you have that same chase. You know, we've played together a bit, and every time either one of us hits that really solid shot, we just kind of look over and smile.
It's the best feeling ever, but my first shot probably was shanked into the pond, so I try to forget that as an experience, Willie, but I admire yours. Like Frank, Willie, there's so many questions I would love to ask you. I'm curious, how good did your game get in terms of your index and all of that, and just maybe the process of trying to become a pro? I know how competitive it is today, and I can only imagine it was similar back in when you were trying.
Yeah, so my lowest index has been, I think, plus 2.8 or something like that. But what's interesting is my mother saved up her money to buy me my first set of golf clubs in right around 1980 or 81. And she went down to McCaffrey's and purchased them. So I think I was 14 going on 15. And the most interesting thing about it was that after maybe a week after I got those clubs, I shot even par for the first time out here at Bing Maloney. I made seven birdies, seven bogeys, and four pars. Okay, So this is 14 years old going on 15. Wow. And from that point on, I knew that I can compete with some of the kids that have been playing longer than I had. And I had all of these little notches, you know, these target guys that I had to be able to beat before I got out of high school. So I think I got good enough to the point where, like I said, it earned me a scholarship. And then coming out of college, I think my sophomore year, I won our SWAC conference championship. And I remember coming home that summer in '86, and there was a pro here named Tom Fisher who had worked for Jim McLean. He says, "Would you mind if I videotape your swing?" I said, "Yeah, sure, no problem. I'm just on the range practicing." I think I'd been home for about a month and a half, and I hadn't shot above 70 since I had been home. And he goes, he videotapes me face on and then down the line. And he goes, "You know," he goes, "McLean and I videotape these guys at Doral and then again at La Costa every year. And I got hundreds of videos." And he goes, "You're in as good a position as everyone we have on film in two positions, at impact and at the top of your golf swing." And he just gave me this hypothetical question. And I'll tell you, this is, if you don't have confidence in your ability to play this game, it makes it real difficult to be really good. He says, hypothetical question. He goes, "You go head to head with Jack Nicklaus. Who wins?" I go, "I do." He goes, "You didn't even hesitate." I go, "Man, if I'm on my game that day," I said, "Jack's got a hell to pay." And he just said, "Oh my God." He goes, "I love it." He goes, "That's the type of confidence you have to be successful at this game." And I was confident. I was really confident. I just, you know, resources, financial resources probably kept me from getting where I wanted to go. My class of guys that I competed against were both of the Sutherland boys, David and Kevin. Scott McCarron was at Vintage in Napa. Larry Silvera, I think, was in the Pittsburgh, Antioch area. All those guys, we all competed against each other. And that's the group that I came up with. And some made it and some didn't. And I was one of the ones that didn't, but that's okay. I still chase it.
I got to think, with what happened with Michael Block in the recent PGA, that's the ultimate thrill for any head pro. I want to get your thoughts maybe watching that. And have you tried to qualify for the PGA yourself over the years?
So the PGA, how you qualify for it as a club pro is you have to finish really low in your stroke play section championship. And yeah, usually the last couple of years I haven't played in it. I've done it on the senior side of it because I'm north of 50 now.
Yeah.
And but I still have not been successful qualifying for the club professional championship, which if you finish in the top 20 there, you get exempt into the field at either the KitchenAid senior, and in the club pro championship, you go into the PGA championship. But you talk about inspiring. It just goes to show that, you know, even as a kid, you dream of moments like that. And then for it to come to fruition, you know, is huge. And it's really inspiring for the rest of us guys that want to be in that same position. You know, so it gives you a goal or a carrot kind of dangled in front of you. And then how you get motivated to do something like that is see someone that's in the same shoes that you're in be successful. And then that gets him in next year because he finished in the top 15. That's amazing.
He's certainly been an inspiration to PGA professionals around the country. We're talking with Willie Toney. He's the new head golf professional at Bing Maloney Golf Course and grew up right there. Willie, we have a couple more questions for you, but I have to take a break. So I'm going to do that, earn some money for the show here, pay some bills, and we'll come right back with more Willie Toney right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
We are back on the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports 1140. Frank LaRosa and Scott Marsh with you. We are talking with Willie Toney, the new head golf professional at Bing Maloney Golf Course, who grew up right there and has come full circle in his career to come back to Bing Maloney. We were talking about Michael Block and what an inspiration he's been to, certainly to golf professionals or club golf professionals around the country. Actually, he's been an inspiration to everybody. But, as you said, Willie, he gets to play in that tournament next year. I guess that, he's had a little trouble qualifying for some other tournaments he's been invited to after that, or making the cut, I guess. That's the notion, I guess, of the difference in practicing every day and where club professionals like you, like Michael Block, don't always have that time every day to do that.
Correct. That is true. We don't. You get into the business and you find out very quickly when you get into the business of golf as a playing professional transitioning in, you don't play or practice as nearly as much as you did when you were playing full time. And that's the trade-off, when you get into the club professional side. Your time gets pulled in multiple directions, with back office, with committees and stuff like that. And that's okay. But when you get an opportunity, you make the most of those time frames where you can practice. You maximize that. And with this game, it's all about the short game. Everyone out there on tour hits the ball well, no matter what tour it is. You can go from LPGA to PGA, the PGA Tour Champions, Korn Ferry. They all hit it well. But in order to be successful and consistently in that top 10, top 25 type deal, your short game has to be twice as good as your long game. So that's what we do now, as club pros. We probably work on that more than we do the ball striking aspect of it.
Yeah, Will, you talk about that difference between being able to practice and working with others. I'm just curious, as you give some of the lessons to people, and obviously you're at a level and most of the people you're training are not, are there some basic things that you try to get to a first-time person who may come to you out of Bing Maloney for some lessons?
Absolutely. So, I'm real big on, you don't have to throw away what you've done for however many years you've been playing this game, even as a beginner. I look at literally, I interview a person and find out what type of sports they played growing up. And if they weren't athletically minded, if you played sports, you can relate something that they're doing in golf to what they did exceptionally well or well, right? So easier to teach an athlete to play the game. Someone that has fundamental sports skills, it's going to pick it up pretty good. And I'm real stickler for just the basics, literally how to hold the golf club. It's the only connection your body has with the golf club or your hands. So once we build you from the grip, then we work on your stance and posture, because everything you do in this game is about balance and leverage. If you don't have balance, you're going to be in trouble from day one, because you'll start to compensate for being out of balance. So in case in point is, if you think about we all have children. Just remember them standing up for the first time. So your brain is like a supercomputer, right? So yep. When they get up and they start to wobble, and then they get trunk heavy and they fall back down, then they get back up and they wobble again. And then finally they stand up straight and they got it, right? The brain is giving them these signals that says, okay, you need to move this way to stay in balance. Your brain doesn't shut off, not until the day you die. So it tells you when you're in balance and when you're not. And when you're out of balance, if you don't correct it before you swing, your brain will make you correct it while you swing. Okay. And in a 2-second swing, you don't have a whole lot of time to make these corrections. So those are the things that I key on, is basically grip and posture. Because if I can get you over the golf ball consistently the right way or the correct way, it's going to make your swing a lot more consistent because your brain's not telling you to do something other than stay balanced, right?
Yep.
Willie, how do you do that? How do you, as an instructor, how do you balance that, you know, which are, as you say, basic skills with the student that, you know, just wants to hit it as far as they can? I mean, the notion of balance is, you know, is certainly something, it's a word I've heard ever since I've been around the game. And you try to maintain that, but as a new player, all I want to do is hit it far. And if I'm going to be out of balance doing it, well, as long as I can hit it, you know, somewhat consistently, that's okay. I guess what I'm saying is we somehow or sometimes tend to overlook the basics that are so important in building throughout the years.
Sure. So if you think about anything that has to do with power, okay. And yeah, in today's golfer, you know, with Tiger's influence on the game, it's a more physical athletic game now. Okay. So, you know, you often hear about them talking about they need to lengthen these golf courses and that sort of thing. But in order to teach distance, two things have to happen. You can't swing and hit anything hard out of bounds. You just can't. So you have to really impress upon your students that if we can't get you balanced over the ball, you can never really apply power, right? So it's like the power hitter in baseball. You know, to take the power hitter's power away, you throw it inside and high because then his arms are shorter. He's adjusting to it, right? So you know that the power alley is from out to in or from inside to out, actually, where your arms can get extended. So if you leave one out over the plate at, you know, just between waist high and knee high, he's going to straighten his arms out and he's going to knock the cover off the ball, right? So golf, same rules apply. If you don't have balance, you can swing as hard as you want as long as you stay in balance. And you're going to make more consistent contact if you are in balance. You cannot substitute balance for power. You just can't. You can't apply it.
You've been away from Bing so many years. As you come back and kind of walk the grounds, what's different and what remains the same?
Oh, let me tell you something. The trees are a lot larger here than they were when I was a kid, especially when you get over to hole 12, man. 12, that cottonwood tree has lost a pretty significant sized branch that used to stretch the foliage almost to the fence line. I mean, it was that big at one point, but it still hasn't gotten any easier. Those two redwoods, though, have grown immensely down that left side. And so now if you're going to cut that corner, you got to take a left of those redwoods and cut it back in, or you just got to take a real high draw over the left corner of the big cottonwood and draw it back in there. It's, you know, that's the most alarming thing is how much larger the trees are than they were when I was a kid. And the fairways ran forever when I was a kid here. They don't run like that, like they used to.
That hole number 12 on Bing was always on everyone's toughest hole list around golf holes in Sacramento.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think it was, I'm trying to remember the sportscaster that used to do the toughest holes in Northern California, tall guy, Eric something. I remember him playing the 12th hole and he just kind of shook his head because he couldn't seem to get it. He couldn't thread the needle. He didn't have enough power to take it over the corner. It just gave him fits. And it has done that to everyone at some point in their career out here.
So what's the same at Bing after all these years?
What's the same? You know, I would just say the layout is still the same. Some of the greens have changed. The 10th hole, when I was a kid, it was straight away. So if you hit it left of that tree down that path where the pines were, you were OB. They did build that, or they extended that to a dogleg left right around the same time that they acquired that land to do the exact nine. You know, so that's the one thing that's changed significantly is that hole. But the rest of the golf course seems just the same. The greens are probably in better shape consistently than they were when I was a kid. Probably in the mid to late 80s, that they were really good then, and this reminds me of that.
And my guess is with you at the helm, that attention to service and detail is probably reminiscent of how it used to be so many years ago.
Yeah, you know, I think when you think about all the people and the relationships that I've kind of been a part of in this environment and this side of the city, I mean, I'm still well connected to it. I see so many people that I grew up with that still patronize this golf course. And it's been fun as they've come in and said, hey, man, we found out you're the head pro again. And so it's been great just rekindling some of those relationships and seeing a lot of my old friends.
Well, Willie, you're an American success story and a feel good story as well to come back to Bing. Scott and I look forward to coming out and saying hi and invite all the folks in Sacramento to go over and play golf at Bing and experience it and say hi to Willie Tony.
Absolutely. And hey, make sure you bring Tom and Dean out here too.
And you know, the best part about it, Willie, now Frank is a lot more convenient to bring you Marie's donuts.
So. Oh, you know, this is true.
Which was just not a plug because I don't know Marie like Frank does, but top 20 in the country in donuts, which was pretty impressive to have a shop in Land Park. So I know Frank will be bringing you them on a consistent basis, my friend.
I love you, Frank, for bringing those. I mean, Marie's is like a historical establishment here on Freeport Boulevard down past McClatchy, man. We used to go there in the morning coming from clubs just to get the donuts as they were being made. They come out warm, man. So, yeah, trust me. I'm looking forward to those Marie's donuts.
Sounds like a date. Willie Tony, PGA golf professional, head golf professional at Bing Maloney. Welcome back to Sacramento. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Golf to Go Radio Hour continues here on Sactown Sports 1140. Hi, I'm Frank LaRosa. Scott Marsh is with me, and we are welcoming in Mr. Eric Lippert. Eric is the head golf professional at Pebble Beach and an old friend. And Eric is also president of the Northern California PGA section, so he wears a couple of hats. Eric, how are you?
I'm doing great, Frank. Scott, good to see you again as well. So always happy to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming back. You know, the last couple of times we've been talking about the United States Women's Open coming to Pebble Beach for the very first time in its 78th year, which is that's pretty remarkable that in the 78th year, it never was at Pebble Beach. But I know everybody is very excited to have it there now. And anything been going on, Eric? You know, what are you keeping busy?
Yeah. Just kind of, finally coming in a little bit before 10 o'clock now and, making sure I stay till at least 4 or 5. But Frank, to go back to what you're saying, the first thing was when you're saying about 7, 8 years, hard to believe. I think in some ways, yes, absolutely. But when you think of the history of the USGA, it really wasn't until 72 where even public courses had any play in it in terms of, like a Pebble Beach and having a US Open and hosting that, right? So 72 was the first time a public course did that. So you think of that 50 years, and in that 50 years, a lot's happened now. Is it well overdue? I would agree. I would argue that yes, it's well overdue. But at the same time, we have in the past been a good friend of the USGA in other ways, being that we've hosted US amateurs, hosted two women's US amateurs as well, actually in 40 and 48. So, and one of the things that was pretty interesting, if you research Pebble Beach's history, is if you look at 1950, 51, when the LPGA Tour first got started, part of the starting point was, it was called the Weather Vane. There was like a circuit of stops along the way called the Weather Vane Open. And Pebble Beach was along that stop during those first couple of years. So there's been professional golf played here. It's just history hasn't quite exposed it enough. But we are very, very well prepared to do that and positioned to do that in about a month. So very excited.
With all the experience that you've had, especially, in somewhat recent years with USGA events, this isn't just another tournament. On the other hand, you probably got a team in place that's well prepared to and know what to do. I mean, when you think about everything that's involved just in a regular golf tournament, you know, from parking to bathrooms, to food, to, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and magnify that by a major event like this. It's keeping everybody on their toes, I'm sure.
Yeah. We're a little unique in terms of how we operate as a resort, in that we tend to do the lion's share of a lot of that prepping and planning internally, partially because we do so many big events in a year. So we have the infrastructure and the teams to really work side by side with USGA. And so that's a great thing. And that's partially, you know, another great benefit aside from the golf course and the facilities that also adds to that relationship for the USGA, is that, you know, it's a year whenever they come to Pebble, not that they definitely take a year off, but certainly that they are able to do a little bit less and get a breather. I mean, they are running all these championships themselves every year. And so to be able to go somewhere like a Pebble Beach, have that facility, have the, you know, the golf course that you're looking at, and also have a team that can work side by side and has a lot of these operational planning pieces in place ahead of time is makes a great relationship from a working standpoint.
And I'm guessing it's got to be pretty exciting for the women as well to you know, play this major championship on such an incredible golf course.
Yeah, it's been outstanding. I think if you watch LPGA Tour golf on the weekends, there's almost not a week that doesn't go by that there's not some form of a reference of what's coming with the U.S. Open. And so, you know, I mean, I think the excitement, not just, you know, Frank, it's kind of like what we talked in the past before when we've been done in other interviews, when we talk about just people's excitement on a daily basis coming here. Mm-hmm. Not that the PGA Tour players take it for granted as much. I think they all appreciate it and enjoy Pebble Beach. That's not it. But I think from an access standpoint and what we're doing in a month is the excitement to see that on the best players in the world in the women's game, the excitement to be coming and playing and hosting this event at Pebble Beach that they have is really, really kind of lends itself to the excitement that we have. It just kind of pushes the whole feeling, you know, up a whole level. So staff wise, when you come here, people are the talking about it. It's just everybody's on the forefront of everybody's mind at the moment. And it's truly exciting to be part of something that hasn't been done here before. And there's very few things that you can say at Pebble Beach that you can be a part of that haven't been done yet. And so a lot of people understand that, and they're very excited to be a part of that.
And if you live in Northern California and have followed any golf at Stanford, there's a young woman that just turned professional and won her first time out. And my guess is she's going to be playing at your golf course in that U.S. Women's Open.
Well, yeah, you know, and so a couple things, right? I mean, so Rose has kind of been forefront for us. You know, we host on an annual basis a tournament called the Carmel Cup. And for the number of years, it's hosted the men's golf teams, people like Victor Hovland, Matt Wolf, to name a couple that are out, you know, and not just playing, but have been very successful in the PGA Tour. And there's about five or six more out there. And Grayson Sigg is out on the tour. He's played in that event since just in my 7 years being here. Well, last year we changed the script the tournament director, Finn Ewan, did. And he brought all the women's teams. And one of the teams he brought was Stanford. And they were absolutely blowing people away. And they continued to do so, right? They did the same thing. But what was amazing was that's where we got our first glimpse of Rose Zhang. And Rose, coincidentally, has the women's course record here at Pebble Beach, which was set last year by her at 63.
Wow.
So the plot thickens, doesn't it?
And that's not, is that one shot different than the men's record?
Hers is 63. The men's is 61. Also, 61. It was shot by Hurley Long in the Carmel Cup as well.
Okay.
AT&T has its own record of, you know, the tournament record of 62, but 61 is the lowest score shot on the golf course. That's the official course record.
Scott, I know you're really excited about the Open coming to Pebble Beach and plan to be down there as well. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, so many things. And you mentioned with Rose Zhang, I mean, winning for the first time in her first event on the LPGA this past week in 72 years, that's phenomenal. And of course, two-time NC2A champ. And you know, some people are talking about her, and it's totally unfair, but it's hard not to make the comparison to a Tiger Woods and being from Stanford and everything else. And I just got to think from a marketing standpoint with what she did, boy, that's really going to make the event even more special coming up.
Yeah. So, you know, when you can say, you know, it's easy to draw comparisons to Tiger Woods, but if you wanted to take college careers, hers is actually better. She won 12 out of 20 events at Stanford. It took him, I want to say 22 or 23 to win 11.
Wow. What a slacker.
I know. You'd think, you know, just when you thought he was trying it, apparently he wasn't. I don't know. But that just shows you how great she is. I mean, I was happened to be at Augusta this earlier in the year for the Anwa. We were doing some site, you know, scoping out, watching the event, and watching her win that in the playoffs. She just has an ease about her and a calmness that is, even when she's not at her best, because I don't think she was that day either on the final round. But it was enough, you know, and to just stay calm like that and to stay present and to be able to give herself a chance to finish it off and then she does.
Pretty amazing. And yeah, Tiger tweeting out after the event, all of that stuff is just so great for the tournament in the area. Of course, there's a lot of other great players. I'm curious, she has the course record at 63. We know the U.S. Open setups are as tough as they get. She saw 63 under different course conditions. So tell us what she can be in store for this time around versus when she shot that 63.
Well, my first comment would be that when you shoot 63, I'm not sure if it matters how long the rough is because you're hitting pretty straight.
That's true. You're not in the rough very often.
However, Scott, to your point, what have we done? Well, we've really looked back at 2019, and we have a very similar footprint for the ladies this year in terms of widths of fairways as we did in 2019. Again, the goal, we're setting this thing up and dialing up a championship that is worthy of any of the best men's championships we've run as well. We're really just completely all in, focused hard on providing and taking advantage of this opportunity for both sides. So golf course wise, it's gonna be very difficult. Fairways are cut in. They're all in now. We've been very fortunate. If you've been in Northern California, you know, there's been a lot of liquid falling from the sky. And so the rough is extremely lush and healthy. So, the big difference would probably be your question. What would be the difference? Obviously some yardage is going to be the difference, length of the course. But I think that lends itself to some unique setup options that the men's game doesn't, because Pebble is not considered a long golf course. And the other part of it is that probably the rough is going to be, it's going to be just a little bit shorter. It's just not going to get to the length, and that's just due to swing speeds. And it's really would be unfair anyway to, make it 5-6 inch rough at this point.
You know, as the PGA head golf professional, you've spent a lot of time on that golf course, during the event you'll be busy as well and won't have time to be there as a spectator. But for spectators that are going to come out, what would you be looking for, or what would you be looking forward to as a fan, and what can you know, what can make the job easier for a spectator in finding the right spot to watch the golf tournament?
Well, you know, I think when I say this, kind of unfortunate, it's not, there's, you know, you're not going to have at the about 40,000 people like you would at maybe a men's open. So I think just in general, walking the grounds is going to be, it's going to be a lot more fan friendly in terms of being able to see the players. Certainly there'll be some large draws with some of the higher named players, like always. But really, Frank, I think it's just a phenomenal opportunity to walk Pebble Beach and it's all its kind of all its glory and watch some of the best golf you can see ever played. These ladies are amazingly good. And I think it's taken for granted sometimes. But the game, the women's game, like when I was in Augusta watching these, just all these amateurs playing, they're all amateurs at this point. You think this is the future of golf here. They're not but 1-2 years away, or some of them, like in Rose's case, you know, a month away. Boy, oh boy, there is a heck of a game that they're playing, and it's phenomenal. The skill sets are phenomenal. The way they manage the courses is fantastic. So your question is, where do you go? You just come out here to Pebble Beach and take a stroll. That's what you do.
Great advice.
And I think for the average person who plays and, you know, hacks around the golf course, I think what will be interesting with this, because the way the tees are and the way the length is, it'll be kind of a more common spot for people who get a chance to play on a regular basis or maybe even get lucky enough to play Pebble Beach someday. Obviously, the course is going to be in a lot tougher condition, but you'll kind of see some general shots that, you know, might make sense from a layout perspective that obviously are unobtainable from the men's game.
Yeah, you know, I think to your point, yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, the one thing everybody comes out after the week or two after or month after of the U.S. Open, and they're thinking, gosh, you know what, I'm going to go out there and try and play my U.S. Open, play from where they want to play, which is absolutely, it's just not reasonable. It's not reasonable. And I would tell you, even at the yardage they're playing, which would be about 6,500 yards, regardless of condition, that's it. It's a championship golf course for a reason. And, you know, the thing I would always encourage people is most people are coming from areas that are a little bit more, the weather is a little more temperate. It's a little warmer. Generally, they get a little more out of their golf balls when they hit them. You know, here it's average around high 50s, low 60s, which, you know, is not conducive to long ball flight at sea level. Right.
Yeah.
And so the combination of their courses always play longer out here anyway. What am I saying, Scott? People play pretty much the wrong tee already.
Yeah.
They should be playing forward. I always laugh and think, gosh, if you want to have your own personal AT&T like you've watched it on TV, then you should be wanting to hit the same 8-iron into the green that the 9-irons that those guys are hitting. And the only way you're going to do that is to move forward enough so that you can hit 8-irons and 9-irons into these tiny greens. I mean, that's part of why this golf course, while it's short for these players, still is relevant because the greens are so small that they need to challenge it off the tee so that they can have short clubs in and have an opportunity at some of these birdies. So you can't hit 4 and 5 irons into these greens and think you're going to be successful. It's never going to happen.
Nope. Eric, when does the course close to the public, and tell us about how to get tickets?
Well, tickets are on USJ, you know, on the USJ website. They're ready to go. I would encourage anybody to get some tickets. It's a wonderful way to watch. It's going to be an amazing tournament to watch in person. You know, so go to USJ website, get your tickets there. When is the course closing? You know, we're handing it over completely on the 2nd of July, but we're kind of reducing play a little bit as we go leading into that time frame too. So, which is again, very similar to what we did with the men's event. You know, we slowly reduce play. We really get the conditions up and running and then hand it over and away they go.
And away they go. Very exciting to have the U.S. Women's Open coming to Pebble Beach. July 5th to 9th are the dates. And so get on the USGA website and find your tickets. Eric, I'm glad you were able to spend some time with us. I know as you ramp up and get closer, things get busier. Appreciate you spending some time with us today.
You bet. And thank you guys. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Frank, Scott, thank you too.
Thank you, Eric.
This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour, and Eric Lippert wraps up another edition. Thanks to my guests, Willie Tony and Eric Lippert. And tune in next week, same time. We'll have more on the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports, 1140.